This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Welcome to the screening of The Girl Who Talked to Dolphins. In 2010, we think, Graham and I were at a conference on whales at the NYPL, where Graham presented a wonderful paper on whales, and a woman sitting in front of us in the auditorium turned around and said, "Professor Burnett, I loved your presentation." And she introduced herself. It meant nothing to me, but Graham said, "Wow, you're Margaret Howe." And then afterwards explained to me who she was. She's the subject of this film, and you'll see why Graham was bowled over.
Is that about right?
It's quite right. Yeah, first time I'd met her, and she had been sort of famously reclusive since the events that are treated in this film.
Since this thing. So I'm going to hand over to Graham, my colleague at Cabinet and historian of science at Princeton, tell you a little bit about the film, and then we'll have Q&A discussion afterwards.
Great. Thanks so much, Sina. Thanks. And thanks for hosting the event. So the subject of this film, which I'm going to go ahead and confess, I have not seen yet. So you're going to get a very fresh response when we do Q&A after the film. I haven't seen. The subject of this film, though, is the subject of chapter of the book I published in the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, called The Sounding of the Whale. And that book is a study of the scientific understanding of whales and dolphins across the 20th century. So it's a very academic book in many respects. It was sort of my second tenure book kind of thing. It's like an 800-page, many footnoted kind of thing that attempts to explain how whales and dolphins went from being understood as, you know, little more than industrial commodities at the beginning of the 20th century, of course being the subject of a very intensive industrial hunt in that period, and their fats being mobilized for use. Do you guys know actually why they killed all those whales with the like big boats with the like mouth in the back that drew them up inside and all of that? So that's like, it's my favorite, it's a teaching moment for me. I would pay for that answer. The lamp oil thing is lets me take a moment on the difference between the 19th and 20th century whaling industries. Right, the 19th century industry, the Moby Dick thing, is lamp oil. That's open boat, guys with cold steel harpoons rowing. Right whales and sperm whales are the main quarries. As against the 20th century industry, which is diesel and diesel-driven vessels, explosive ordnance, those big grenade harpoons on the bow of power-driven catcher boats, and then the big ocean-going factory vessels that process the animals at sea, that industry was not about lamp oil because, of course, the whole world was electrified at that point. So, well, the whole world. The relevant folks who had lots of money to pay for large-scale exploitation of natural industries were making use of electricity at that point and had no need for whale oil for lamps. What was done with all that stuff? Dolphins were killed well through the 20th century for the very, very fine-grade oil in their jawlines. So a very, very uniquely weird lubricants for fine timekeeping devices came from dolphins all through the 20th century. But the big ones,
watches
and that kind of thing, that's correct. The dolphin oil is not edible. You're getting me do this several times over the years. So yeah, the crazy thing about what was done with all the whale oil in the 20th century was that it was largely hydrogenated and turned into margarine. So it became the kind of primary fat. in consumption in most of Europe in the period after the Second World War. Was that shaking heads because you don't think that's true, or shaking heads just because it's so crazy and gross? Yeah. It didn't happen in the United States, interestingly, because of the dairy lobby, which was more than the wheat farmers' lobby, and therefore was always able to keep margarines kind of at bay in this country. So margarines had a tough go of things in the U.S., but not so in Western Europe. So the lower grade oils from those big animals, you know, some 3 to 4 million of which were taken out across the second half of the 20th century, was saponified, so turned into turned into soap. And during a couple of weird moments in the early 20th century, the byproduct of that saponification reaction, namely glycerin, which was normally just kind of a lower value product, was actually a higher value product because of its use in nitroglycerin-based explosives, as for instance during the First World War, less so by the Second World War. But all of this is marginal to what we're going to talk about today, which is dolphins. So the book, though, the book does whales and dolphins. And part of what the book hinges on toward the end, and what the BBC guys who set out to make this film got interested in, because though I haven't seen the film, I am, for a couple of moments, unfortunately, looking, I think, a little like a psychopath in the film. And the film is sort of, to a substantial degree, although I didn't gouge them for a bunch of money on it, basically on chapter 6 of my book. We'll see how they did with it. It makes me a little anxious, but it's sort of about that. Is about this crazy shift in the understanding specifically of the animal Terciops truncatus, the bottlenose dolphin, that happens sort of in the early 1960s. It's the moment of Flipper, which premieres in 1963 and gives Americans a kind of domestic marine mammal, which seems intelligent. It's sort of like Lassie, but in a kind of ocean environment. And it happens at a moment where Americans are really interested in the marine environment. And there's a story to be told about the rise of CLAB in the early 1960s and a kind of shift to understanding the oceans as our inner space as opposed to the outer space of the space race, which from the late 50s and early 1960s was another kind of significant broad cultural phenomenon. So this story set in the early 60s is part of that. And the subject of the film, the kind of, at least the sort of guy behind the curtain in the story, is this very strange pioneering renegade neurophysiologist named John Cunningham Lilly, John Lilly, who was a brain scientist. He was a medical doctor and a kind of neurophysiologist interested in cortical mapping in the 1950s and working for the National Institutes of Mental Health, largely working on macaques, on monkeys. And at the end of the sort of psyops clandestine services communities in Washington and around Bethesda in the late 1950s.
Wait, so, is he American or British? Because, I mean, the film is a British film.
It's a British film, but Lilly was American, very American. Correct. The story is American. So Lilly basically was an NSF career grant winner who was working on the kind of access to the brain at a time that Manchurian candidate to, era preoccupation with access to the inner life of the Cold War subject was a major kind of national and international issue. He's one of these amazing guys who kind of tunes in, turns on, drops out between 1957 and 1965. So he's got major money, including from the military, to do the work that's going to be shown to you in this film, namely to build an experimental laboratory to study interspecies communication. He blows out on macaques circa 1957-58 and gets interested in dolphins, which have very large brains, and which he believes are capable of communication, something like language. And so he works on those animals in the late 50s and then especially in the early 1960s with funding from NASA, with funding from the Office of Naval Research, and from many other folk. And you could ask why NASA would see this in the film. But the idea that we needed a model organism for the moment of breakthrough to a non-human intelligence was a saleable grant writing project circa 1961. So you feel that? You need an animal model. You're gonna make contact at some point. When you do, you wanna know how you go about establishing a ground for communication, and it would be good to have an animal model for working on that. And Lily sells dolphins as the ideal animal model for working up that sort of a kind of program for how you do it to begin to establish communication with a non-human intelligence. So that's part of what happens. The project in the early 60s, as you'll see, goes a little kind of wacky as the different techniques available for doing this work, including psychotropic agents, which are good for enhancing communication. I'm talking about LSD, of course, which was used to enhance communication in the veterans' hospitals in the United States before it became the LSD that you know as acid post-Leary. It was an experimental product used as a supplement to the psychotherapeutic encounter because it reduced inhibition and enabled people to speak more freely about their emotions and experiences. So Lilly is at the edges of that world, again, because of his military links, and experiments with sort of all the different components of the toolkit of those Cold War sciences of mind and behavior with the dolphins in the early 1960s, culminating in what you'll see here. So let's see what Christopher Riley and the BBC did with the story of Margaret Howe and the Communications Research Institute in the Virgin Islands in the early 1960s. Should we roll it?
The film was then screened, followed by Q&A.
No particular plan for what happens next. As I said, I hadn't seen that before, and I'm probably too deep in the kind of archival stuff to better to hear what you guys think. What's it like? What does it look like to you guys? Thoughts? Yeah. I didn't and didn't really know anything about Bridges' relationship to any of it, which I'm confessing the end isn't precisely clear. Did you guys feel that? I mean, Lily definitely ends up living. Yeah, friend of Lily. Like, yeah, Lily ends up with the jumpsuit and like a huge promoter of vitamin K, and definitely like a character in Los Angeles. All across the, like, you know, 80s, 90s, like, you know, spreads in Omni magazine and that kind of stuff. And he definitely had a kind of, you know, friends out there. He actually goes to Esalen. He goes to Esalen Institute when things tank in 67 and sort of, you know, reinvents a second act before the coonskin cap. That's really very overripe. But there's a kind of middle period of which apparently there's no footage. I must say it's very affecting for me to see the footage because I'm basically an archival historian, so I didn't see a lot of that stuff and I didn't work a lot with sound tapes. I directed Christopher to the Lilly Archive, which is at Stanford, and I knew that the tapes and the film was there, but he found the Jack Parr show stuff, which I'd never seen myself. It was the first time I saw that. I knew those shows had existed because I found references to them, but I have to say it's very cool to see the footage. I mean, it's just... film research is like its own thing, and I'm just not, that's not my thing. I write books, so I don't know anything about that. So I didn't know about the Bridges part of things, and I hadn't seen a lot of that stuff with what happens to him. And I have a lot of things to say about how interesting it is from a history of science perspective to see Lily's transit, which is comical, of course, like in a way, but of course is only comical sort of because we... how to understand that moment, like the Lily moment, like the Leary moment, the Lily moment, like Ram Dass, like 64, 65, 66, like what happens? It's so complicated. And I don't think it really did a very bad job, honestly, but it still is like funny in a way that we can't quite really do the cultural history yet because it's too close. It's like kind of our moms and dads, and we've seen those footages, like we've seen those pictures in the albums, and so it's going to take another 30 years before we can kind of really get what it was, maybe, or more. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah. maybe let's go ahead with, I'm sorry, if we could, just you wait. Okay, please, go ahead.
Okay. My understanding of the current state of scientific knowledge or research in human-animal communication is that if you could talk about this, that I understand there have been experiments with apes, chimpanzees especially, and there's a level of belief in the scientific community that chimpanzees can be taught some level of human language with understanding, unlike the what the film suggests was merely a mimicry of sound without comprehension. And if you could comment upon that and correct maybe an incorrect presumption on my part.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I'm a historian of science, so like I'm kind of like card-carrying competent to talk about all science, you know, kind of before now. So I'm not a scientist. You know. So I have a lot of things to say about this moment in the 60s when, for instance, and these are things that the film can't treat because there's a certain kind of depth that can't be done in this format, I don't really know. Like the idea of cohabiting with animals to teach them language was a standard part of the animal behavior repertoire in this period. Keith and Kathy Hayes, who were shown very briefly with their chimpanzee, were doing this kind of work in the 50s. And so Lily / Margaret were kind of doing something that was already kind of well established as kind of one of the possible repertoires for establishing different forms of communication. So I'm still talking about the period. I'm not really answering your question. I'm going to come to your question in a second. It's worth saying, too, like, again, things the film can't really handle. Lots of people are giving LSD to animals in the early 1960s. That's presented as a kind of deranged sort of mad scientist thing, which in some ways it kind of was by the time Lily was doing it. Lily was quite, like, he done crossed over by the time those experiments were happening. But really, he done crossed over by the time a 22-year-old girl is, like, living in the tank with the dolphins. I mean, it's over by this point. That the film has trouble with that because it's not so interesting if this is itself all kind of post the fail, but it kind of is really. Like, Lily's funding is catastrophic by 64. This is just getting going then. He's actually under a two-book contract, so the first book, which makes all those kind of promises and makes him super famous in 61, he has to deliver another book a couple of years later because he's under a two-book contract, and he's kind of desperate to get something for the second book. But he's become like a media figure by this point, and a huge chunk of what he's managing is just celebrity, which is, in that sense, he's the kind of one of the early scientists to try to kind of manage that transition into sort of celebrity status and fail at it in a certain kind of way. So there are lots of people giving LSD to all kinds of animals to study their reactions, and that's not especially strange. So what do people say now about animal behavior? I mean, my understanding too, like yours, which is more or less derived from kind of like, you know, reading the press, is that people believe that there's a lot more that can be done teaching animals within certain constraints, semiotic systems that permit certain kinds of free creative expression. Dolphins, as you know, do pretty well with the mirror test, which is another one of those interesting kind of things, where they appear to have some kind of qualities of self-knowledge. But I'm not really an expert on like what people do now. There may be people in the audience here who want to speak to this question. If there's anybody who's doing kind of current experimental work on this kind of stuff, it's not my thing. I know a lot about the history of this period, but I don't know a lot about what's going on right now. Nina, should we move the...
I'm going to change my question from the one I had in mind first. So I guess my question is about the anthropomorphic. And is it Rick Berry, is that his name? Who says, you know, I don't want to be anthropomorphic or anything. But the film certainly has no problem claiming things like, it was a broken heart, they were in love. And I guess it's a question, I'd be curious to hear your take on how the anthropomorphic, and maybe we could just apply it to whales and dolphins to keep things a little bit limited, has kind of shifted and changed. I mean, I know this is a huge thing in your book, but what the sort of feeling about maybe that as a tendency is now. And I mean, I've heard people argue for it, people argue against it. It's better for animals if we think it one way or another way. I don't know, if there's a sort of view on this within the history of science that would be interesting to bring in at this point.
This is a great question. So anthropomorphism kind of anthropomorphism and epistemology, like what's the status of anthropomorphism as a form of knowledge? And I'll just basically cite Greg Mittman on this, who's a really, really great historian of science. He and Lorraine Daston, Daston being the co-author of that great book that I think some of you will know, Objectivity, Peter Galison and Lorraine Daston, a book of a couple of years ago about visual representation in the sciences since the early modern period. Mittman and Daston co-edited a volume on humans and animals now maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Great volume. And in the introduction to that volume, Mittman writes about anthropomorphism and zoomorphism. And he says, like, you ought to keep them in kind of sync. Zoomorphism is the tendency to try to understand humans in animal terms, anthropomorphism being the effort to understand animals in human terms. And so in the end, the book that they do is sort of, and he puts it this way, and I think it's a brilliant formulation, that really what we have to be interested in is the morphic of both the zoomorphism and the anthropomorphism. That is, the quality of change that is the wager once one tries to use one set of categories to understand the other. You know, what is deformed as we oscillate back and forth between these frames of reference in an effort to achieve something like commensuration. And I do think that commensuration, which is another Mittmanian term, this is Greg Mittman's term, really important for me as I thought about these experiments. Unsettling as Lilly's sort of late mad scientist work is, he was really kind of very exciting in his ultimately unsatisfactory but truly visionary efforts to sort of focus on the requirement that the human subject become an instrument in relation to its object of inquiry in this kind of experimentation. So he's closer to a kind of ethnographic sensibility, not unknown in the, you know, Tinbergen and Lorenz tradition of ethology, so one wouldn't want to suggest that he makes this up out of whole cloth, but he's like, and basically he's like on a plane, like, you know, meeting with JFK's, like, you know, Minister of Education. He's not really focused on what's going on at the Dolphin House by you know, when Margaret is doing all this. Lily's in the middle of a second divorce. He's, you know, he married a fashion model, and he just, you know, he was just paying no attention to what was going on here. And they totally minimized the fact that he actually had a whole other laboratory in Coconut Grove in Miami. They allude to it, but that's really where he was during most of this, and he was doing a whole bunch of other stuff over there. So the story is, the narrative's a little kind of wacky here, but he did have this idea that the problem wasn't them, i.e. the animal subjects, the problem was us, in a sense. We had to figure out how to kind of open ourselves. So he's in psychotherapy. There's a really interesting essay for any of you who are out there who are like, you know, young STS people looking for an essay that you can write to get published. The essay we need is an essay on the impact of Lily's own experience of psychotherapy as a sort of how he integrated certain aspects of his own psychotherapeutic breakthroughs as he began to move toward the dolphins. I mean, really, he has a sort of Freudian psychoanalytic aspiration where the animals are concerned. As he begins to endow them with intelligence, he gets less interested in that sort of cybernetic Cold War, it's a little thing, you press a button, it produces a response sense of the brain, and more interested in this kind of formless, mythopoetic sense of our minds as these expansive spaces. And he gets that more really from psychotherapy than he does from doing drugs, although then he's doing drugs, you know, and that becomes part of it. So that idea of like knowing the animal by sort of sourcing the animal within and trying to commensurate the self with the animal, super important for him. The film doesn't mention it, I don't know why, but it's one of the craziest things about Lily, that his prehistory, 55, at NIMH in Bethesda, he's the innovator, inventor. He's credited with the invention of, are you ready for this? It's going to blow your minds. The flotation tank as a technique for sensory deprivation in, really, interrogation. That is, as you know, like one of the things these guys do is they figure out ways to kind of break a recalcitrant subject, and they do it with drugs, and they sodium pentothal and all that kind of stuff, and they also do it by putting you in a safe house with an incredibly like hot girl who gradually wears down your resistance, think Margaret Howe and the dolphin, and then they also do it by basically cutting you off from any sensory access whatsoever, and so you just go stark, raving, fucking lunatic, mad, and you're willing to say anything, and then they slowly rehabilitate you and get you to talk about your, you know, your contacts in the SAS or whatever it is. And Lilly was the guy who produced the flotation tank of water, warm, body temperature, no sound, no contact with anything, float you in there for 24 hours. And that's way, like, LSD, who needs it? You don't even need to bother with getting in touch with Sandoz and getting the pills. You just put somebody in one of these tanks for 8 or 10 hours and they totally are like raving 90% of the time. He did that to himself repeatedly, and he put a tank, a flotation tank, in the laboratory in the Virgin Islands so he could float in the tank. Because by this point, he wants to know what it's like to be a dolphin, and he figures, like, that's what it's like to be a dolphin, so I gotta, like, get with the dolphins by, like, floating in the tank and being like a dolphin. And he even hooks up, like, a stereophonic link where there's speakers in the tank and speakers in his tank, and he can kind of do that, like, you know, stereophonic psychedelic head trip of kind of access to the dolphins. So there's a lot of other amazing stuff going on, though it's definitely over the line. But in answer to anthropomorphic, I would just say put the zoomorphic back in, focus on the morphic, where you can, like, sort of see what changes when you try to do this kind of thought work in relation to the other, you know, for the Taussig folks in the audience. Like, this is about alterity in a very fundamental way. Yes, where's the microphone?
Yeah.
There's one here, okay. We'll come back around. Please, after you, please.
No.
You're just stretching.
Well, it's interesting to me that John Lilly comes around after all those years and realizes that he's made mistakes, but that the character of Margaret does not. So at the very end, when she's listening to the recording, and she's waxing reminiscent, and you get a little twinkle in her eye, and she's reminded of the love for Peter, I fully expected her to say, oh, he said 5. Yeah, that shit's fucked up. But she didn't. So she didn't, like, come around and be like, what I did was wrong. It was just a completely naive and true character. It just seems like she was just true to her feelings about it all the way. And maybe she thinks something differently and wouldn't want to put it on film, but I didn't get that feeling. So that's just interesting to me. Like, I expected to see some change of heart or some realization. It doesn't seem like she got there.
Interesting. You know, this is one of those moments where, like, in order to write the book, like, one of the things I had to do, maybe wrongly, because some people who read the book don't like it for this reason, I don't have a big, like, personal take on the whale thing, you know? As people kill people kill animals. Like, personally, I'm, like, against, like, a lot of killing and stuff, but I'm a historian, so, like, I put on my, like, stupid scientistic hat, and I'm just, like, I'm trying to understand what, like, people then were saying, so that sometimes they kill whales, sometimes they gave LSD to dolphins. Like, I don't judge. I just try to, like, explain. You know, I just try to tell a story. So I hear what you're saying about how, you know, Margaret too should have, like, tuned in, turned on, and got the news that, like, what she was doing was, like, a sort of a kind of violence to a wild animal. These are wild animals, ultimately. What the fuck are they doing, trying to, like, get a fish by making weird sounds? I can feel it, but I mean, I should just admit that I myself don't. I'm not in the ethical game to an extent, in a way that maybe, you know, makes me persona non grata in this crowd. But I couldn't do the work I've done around such a fraught topic as whaling, because you can't get anybody to talk to you if you like show up and you're like, well, of course it's wrong ever to kill a whale. So can I see your archive, by the way? You know, you have to be like, I'm a historian. Like, show me the archive, because I'm trying to figure out what happened. So that's interesting. But look at how cheap, like, kind of giant shifts in ethical orientation ultimately are. I mean, Lily's like, I'm setting the animals free. Like, that was like, I've got no money, and I'm really hoping that Esalen Institute is going to support me, and because the Navy certainly isn't anymore. And so, you know, how adventitious is this self-reinvention? From being in the archives, and I, you know, was like, I'm kind of semi-proud of being the first person to like razor open boxes of Lily's archive at Stanford, like, you know, open them up, like there's like actual like mouse shit on the top of the files, like you know, shake it out, open the files. From being in the files, I just think Lily was an amazing kind of mechanistic cipher. He was formed in the world of the Right Stuff era, Second World War, physicist from Caltech. He had, I'm going to just say it, like turn off the mic. He had no soul. You know, he had no soul. He was a machine. And ultimately, in those late days when he's like talking about the beauty of the dolphins, he's writing books about God as a machine, you know, the big computer of God's brain. He was made in the world of that fucked up cybernetic thing, and he never recovered. And in that part of what's so crazy is to see the extent to which the counterculture's sort of flower power softness has these kind of unsettling tap roots in that world of the kind of mechanistic Cold War cybernetic machine sensibility. So I don't know, but I hear what you're saying. There's a question here.
I thought it was kind of interesting.
Sina, do you have the mic for this guy? And you should keep. You should tell me when we're out of time, Sina.
Who,
too,
who's it?
The gentleman. Yeah.
You're not stretching this time.
No, I wasn't. I was actually talking. I was just going to comment on the fact that, you know, with Margaret and the raccoon fella. You kind of have the same sort of ethos. You kind of have this, you know, Eisenhowerian, or however you might want to put it, like, you know, extreme positivity, and, you know, that science and positivism, you know, in that era was going to lead us to some sort of result that was, you know, it's going to break a mold or something like that. But it's expressed so wildly differently between, you know, the Margaret that, of course, would never dare, like, inject herself with LSD, and certainly not Peter, who she grew an emotional attachment to whatever degree. But anyway, I just wanted to comment. It was really more of a reflection about how they kind of mirror, they have a similar attitude, kind of like, you know, planted in the same sort of historical soil. But, you know, it's still at the same time really divergent how, you know, they think about the subject or how they went about doing, you know, they both probably thought, well, I don't know how much the doctor really thought that it was working. You know, maybe like you said, he...
Which doctor? Lily or the...
Lily, right. Lily. Like, you know, like you were saying, was adventitious, and then he just started, like, you know, believing his own bullshit, you mm-hmm. know, and wanted the money and the money stream, and he's hanging out in Miami and eventually dropping acid and all that other stuff, and, you know, someone else is sort of taking care of it, and he believes in it, but, yeah, you know, whatever, the show must go on, but she really does believe in it. Like, even in that last interview, she's like, yeah, it was only 6 months. I mean, fuck, you know, a baby doesn't know shit in 6 months.
Right.
So not, obviously not touching on the architecture of the brain between a dolphin, which I don't know jack shit about, and a human, but.
Right. I mean, I would just say that one of the deep, you know, to the extent that some of you are interested in, like, the larger historic kind of plate tectonics that's happening in relation to this, I do think that question of how you get from an Eisenhower era engineer wearing a pocket protector to the guy in the coonskin cap, is the story, and it is definitely funny. Don't get me wrong. I've been talking about this stuff for on and off for a decade. It's somewhat embarrassing to admit, and I still find it kind of funny and understand the reaction. It's a laugh reaction, but there's a genuine, like, historical question here, which is, you know, what the fuck? Like, how? You know, what happens between 1956 and 1966? And that's, you know, this is one of those stories. And the boundaries of these worlds are defined by the trajectories of a few key figures. And Leary is a more significant figure, but Lily is a significant figure as those trajectories go. I'll say one more thing quickly, which is totally omitted from the film, but really interesting and important. There's only so much you can do in this, but much more important in the book, which is what happens. Lily's got all this money from ONR, from the Office of Naval Research, and from the Navy, and from other branches of the military by 63. But in 63, 64, the Navy actually creates its own marine mammal research program. And it does so initially at Point Magoo, and then subsequently at Point Loma in San Diego. And they actually set up like a dedicated research initiative into Tursiops truncatus. And in fact, the guy that Lily gets his first dolphins from, the vet at Marine Studios, is a guy named Forrest Wood, who is the guy who's put in charge of the Navy's marine mammal program. They are actually all former military guys, because everybody in that era was, right? You couldn't be anywhere between 18 and 29 in 1944, 45 without having been in the military. So everybody's a former kind of shave-headed dude. Lily, Forrest, Wood, everybody. But Wood is still enough of a towhead that they pull him in close-cropped, and he runs the Navy's marine mammal program, which ultimately, as you guys will know, some of you, they train marine mammals to work in the open sea in connection with Sea Lab, and ultimately they deploy a set of dolphins as to intercept Viet Cong sappers at Cameron Bay in 1971-72. So they send dolphins with Navy frogmen out to Vietnam to, like, sonar sweep the bays and, like, try to, you know, catch sappers who are basically blowing up an ammunition and fuel depot in Vietnam. So that program is totally clandestine by 67, 68, but part of what's happening in this moment, 64, 65, is Lily's military funding is drying up because they've decided to bring the whole project in-house. Whereas Lily himself in 61, 62 was like, hey, guys in the military, you got a hydrodynamically efficient animal that's super intelligent. Navy people, this is like something we should be training to, like, work in the open sea and stuff like that. So he loses that battle and finds a new group of allies in the counterculture. And that relationship between the kind of Cold War, the Cold War military-industrial complex and the way it goes by the late 60s, as against the counterculture, they are Siamese twins at this moment. Like 62, 63, a guy like Lily could go either way. He actually shows up back at Point Magoo in 66 when he's like driving down the coast from Esalen, and he's like visits everybody. And people are like, people on base have a cow. They're like, get this fucking guy out of here. But they were all friends 3 years earlier. I mean, the guy who ran the Navy's missile complex was a classmate of Lily's at Caltech, the guy who developed the Sidewinder missile. They were all buds. That's part of how the military got interested in dolphins, because he and Lily were friends. So it's like, it breaks in these years. And this story is partially about that. And by leaving out the military side of things, it's harder to tell that story. Should we wrap
up? One more question?
Yeah.
One more? If there is, maybe one more. There is one.
One more.
Do you think the fact that Margaret was not, like, a credentialed male scientist in the 50s had a lot to do with, like, how people dismissed her work?
Not really. I mean, it was certainly not a help. But no, Lily was toast on the whole project quite without any of this. Like, as I said before, like, his research program was already being killed before this started happening. And it was being killed because there were several whole disciplines about which he knew absolutely fucking nothing. So there was, for instance, the entire field of animal behavior. And he just didn't know anything about that. He was like a guy who studied physics at Caltech and then worked on aviation physiology. And he certainly believed that he was a very brilliant man, and he was no slouch. But there were like whole disciplines in which he was just completely inept. Tom Sebiak helped define the field of zoosemiotics in the late 50s and early 1960s, zoosemiotics being the whole discipline of like animal signaling behavior. There were people who were working, for instance, very importantly, ornithologists on like, you know, signaling systems in birds, and also people doing insect stuff who'd done all kinds of work, herpetologists on frog signaling. There was like a universe of stuff going on. He didn't read in the literature, he didn't know anything about it, and he thought he was kind of too cool to have to bother reading it, but those dudes reviewed his book. And they said his book was totally ignorant. And they also kept an eye on his peer-reviewed publications and noticed that there were very, very few. And what little like launches he offered to science and nature were just machine-gunned into oblivion because they weren't any good. And that was all, again, before this. So he was dead. So if Margaret had been an amazing, famous scientist doing that work at that time, it wouldn't have gone anywhere anyway because the work was kind of no good in some basic sort of way. The Navy actually develops vocoders for translating the frequency range of human speech like down up into dolphin auditory range and vice versa. And like unbelievably enough, like out in their laboratories in Hawaii, like tries to like speak Hawaiian with dolphins. And that's like really like, that's controlled experimental work that's being done, and that continues into the late 60s, and that's good work, although it's still very odd, but this kind of work was going, in some general sense, nowhere. Maybe before we stop, I must say, I'm just interested in y'all's like critical response to the film, because as I say, like you probably tell, I was somewhat affected by it, just because it's kind of amazing for me to see the footage, and also to hear that stuff, which I hadn't heard much of. So I would just be interested real quick, like maybe as a parting thing, on like how the film felt, despite its moments of goofiness. Like, did it suck? I can't really tell. I just don't have any way of knowing. Or was it kind of good? Do people have like a view? Miami. It's a great point. I mean, I'm teaching this semester in a graduate historical methods class, and we actually read Hayden White's Metahistory last week, which some of you will know is a book about the kind of essential implotments upon which all historical storytelling kind of supervenes. And you do feel that this one kind of Chris, I mean, he's just doing his job, like he's making up a story that can be shown on TV, but it is like, it's need to create a certain kind of primitive implotment of kind of tragic love tale is kind of, it just sucks. I mean, it's a disaster for what could be done if you were prepared to go harder toward kind of attempting to escape from those preset kind of narrative typologies, and this one just, it doesn't get out of one of those. for all its power, and I want to say again that I found it quite more affecting than I thought I was going to. And I really do think it doesn't do a bad job trying to tell a complicated story, given that, like, when you see one of these scripts on paper, it's so, for a person like me who writes books, it's so weird to see how few words you get. You know, it's like, oh my God, really? You're going to do it with that? And you look and there's like, you know, there's like 96 words on each page and you got like 18 pages and you're like, oh my God, you're dead. So maybe we deserve to, maybe we ought to give Chris a shout out in absentia. He wanted to know what you guys thought of it, so I will make him feel good about it.
So thank you so much,
yeah,
Graham.
Thank you, Chris.
Please thank you.